The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab Premium, version 308, version episode 308, for Thursday, January 6th, 2011. Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. You know the show. It's the show where you send in the questions, you send in the tips, we share what we know. From baby, it's cold outside, Durham, New Hampshire. I'm Dave Hamilton.
Yeah, it is cold, and a storm's a brewing, from what I hear. At least for us.
Yeah,
we got a blizzard warning or something, or something weather.
That's anyways, John F. Braun. That's right.
Fairfield, Connecticut, and then back up in New Hampshire.
It's Pilot Pete. Glad to be with you guys. And is it technically speaking? It's not cold, but it's lack of warmth, right? I mean. Lack of energy.
Sure. Let's go with that. That sounds good. Who invited this guy?
Mr.
I showed up with a note from my mother. That's it.
Yeah, I can't read what she said, though. You know, so we've got quite a few questions and such here. But, John, you and I both did something recently that bears discussion, and that is we both migrated our calendars in MobileMe. Now, MobileMe about somewhere between 3 and 7 months ago, depending on when you hopped into this process, moved their calendar syncing from whatever solution, you know, customized private API solution they used in the past to the industry standard CalDAV solution, which allows for a whole lot more functionality. And it also makes the syncing process a lot smoother, right? So previously, if you wanted to sync your calendars between two of your own machines, you had to log in to MobileMe Sync inside the system preferences, you know, go in there, go to MobileMe, sign up and click the checkbox there. And then via sync services, your calendars would get synced, at least in theory. It was always sort of wacky. And it never, I don't know, for me, it never really worked right. I mean, it would work and then it would stop working and there was no real way to look and see what was going on. And it was always this convoluted mess because sync services is this sort of black box. It would sync, you know, iCal saw your calendars as local calendars and then those calendars would be synced locally on your Mac between iCal and MobileMe and sync services. And then sync services would sync it up to Apple's cloud, however it chose to do that. Then on the other end, it would sync down from the cloud to sync services, and then sync services would sync it to iCal. So it was this big convoluted process.
And I think they refer to it as a hive of bees, or at least a
swarm of bees
meddling with sync services, which is stored deep in the OS somewhere. But yeah, I remember the article you told me about, and they say that don't even think of touching this because it can accomplish no good.
That's right. Yes, that's right. So and then they allowed you, and this was not through sync services, right? So these two things were separate, but. If, for example, you had a calendar that you wanted other people to be able to see, you could publish that calendar. They created this whole thing that they called publish and subscribe. And this started years ago. And it was fine at the time, but it got pretty antiquated because it never evolved. What would happen is if you had a calendar like, for example, John, you know, we have our Mac Geek Gab calendar. Now, if I had published that previously in MobileMe, you could not edit it. All you could do was see it. If I published it to you and you subscribed, there was no two-way syncing. So we actually reverted to Google Calendar for the past several years and it worked just fine. With CalDAV, however, that brings to the table a lot of the functionality that that we had with Google Calendar and some even newer stuff. What it does is it allows the calendars are no longer considered local. The copies of them are local, but the calendars themselves are hosted on the server, similar to how we talk about IMAP with mail. Right. It's the server is the home for all this stuff. And then all of your clients, including your Mac, just sync to it. So we made this migration, John, and we can talk about the process a little bit. In fact, I did this a couple of weeks ago. You just did it recently. So talk quickly through. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, no, I trusted you, Dave, and
I
trust you pretty much implicitly. But no, in the web interface, when I went to the calendar, there was a little ribbon, and it just, you know, said, "Click here if you'd like to migrate."
And so you clicked.
I clicked, and then it said, "Well, you know, you may have to wait a little while." And I saw some progress bars, and then at some point, it said, "Well, you know, depending on the, you have a lot of events and stuff, so you know, wait about an hour before you do anything." And I did, and then eventually, I think in less than an hour, I got an email,
okay,
from .Mac saying, "Yep, all done." And I'm like, "Oh, well, that's cool. Well, let me see how things are different." And one of the first things I did was start up iCal. And I started up and I noticed that one of the categories that I used to have there, which I guess was the old sync, had disappeared. And then I started panicking. And then all of a sudden, the new one appeared under the other calendars, or a new one appeared in my list. And then it started syncing and it basically mirrored what was in the Google calendar. And I'm curious how you migrated that, Dave, how you magically, I mean, I'm sure you didn't manually copy and paste everything from one to the other.
No,
but all the identical events appeared in both calendars. And I guess we're not going to ditch the Google one.
Let's back up a little bit. Let's not talk about this migration from the Google calendar yet, but we will.
Okay.
But you know, it's just as far as migrating your Mobile Me calendars from the old to the new, you're right. After you were done and the point you made about waiting until it's done is huge, because this is all happening on Apple's back end. Now, the first step, which you, of course, were doing, but it bears being explicit about, is first making sure that your calendars are syncing correctly to the old Mobile Me. Right. If that's not happening, then it's not going to migrate over, because it's those calendars that are on the cloud that are going to get migrated. It has nothing to do with what's on your computer. So, you know, making sure that you're synced up and everything's good, then doing exactly what you said, John, and, you know, go through that process and then wait until it's truly done to launch iCal. Because what's going to happen is all your old calendars are going to go away, and then iCal's automatically going to subscribe you to your new calendar on their CalDAV server. And as long as you're a Mobile Me customer, of course, you have access to your data out there. So, which I guess makes Apple kind of the Gestapo at that point, but that's okay. You know, we're going to send them our money anyway. We might as well do it for this. But yeah, so then it just works, but it allows some cool things, because, I'll explain later. I'll do this a little out of order, but once we got there and I had the Mac Geek Gab calendar in my Mobile Me account again, I just went in and I said, "Share this with John Braun." Now, I had to give him your Mac.com address or your me.com, whichever you use. But then you got an email, right, that said subscribe, and boom, all the events were there, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, the cool thing is, and Google Calendar syncing worked a similar way, but John, I want you to try something, if you would, for me. We're going to do this live here. Go into the iCal and create a to-do on the Mobile Me calendar for Mac Geek Gab, if you would, because that is one that we share, and make it for today. And I want to see something. See if this works.
So I'm going to go to File and say New To Do.
Correct.
All right. It's kind of sitting here.
It's probably just waiting for you to type, right? It's probably already put it on the
calendar.
I see.
I'm sorry. Okay. Sorry. No, you're right. Okay. And then on the right hand side, okay, it says to do items by priority.
Yeah.
New to do, and I'm going to say do Mac Geek Gab.
All right.
Premium. And I'm going to close that.
All right. Now you should see the little sync spinny icon go. Did it go?
Okay. Some spinning.
Okay.
It's still spinning.
All right. Let me know when it stops spinning. It shouldn't take very long.
It stopped.
Okay. So now I am opening up Busy To Do on my iPhone, which syncs with Mobile Me. And sure enough, I see an undated to do called Do Mac Geek Gab Premium appear immediately in my thing. So what I'm going to do, John, is I'm going to check that to do off, and that will automatically sync back with the CalDAV server. And at this point, John, I think you created a second to-do, because I see another to-do called New To-Do.
Yeah, I'm trying to get rid of it.
I'll get rid of it. I can do it right from here.
And I see a check mark here.
So the check mark appeared. That's pretty cool.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Yeah.
These computers are magic.
Yeah. So this is what CalDAV allows you to do. And as you just heard, it's seamless. We didn't plan this. I thought about it in the shower about 20 minutes ago that it would be cool to do it this way. So yeah, so it works. So what I had to do, and I figured this would work because I've been using this for a couple of weeks, but I had to migrate the Google Calendar, what the data we had in Google Calendar, over. Now, I used BusyCal to do it. My guess is you could do this with an iCal, but I trust BusyCal a lot more because it shows me logs and I can see what's going on. So I highlighted the old Mac Geek Gab. Well, first I renamed the old Mac Geek Gab calendar in Google to old so that when they showed up in my calendar lists, I could separate them out because I'm not smart enough to notice where they actually are. So I figured I'd rename it. Then I highlighted it, and in the file menu from BusyCal, I chose export, and I just exported it to an ICS file. And I'm pretty sure you can do this with iCal as well. Then I created a new blank calendar on Mobile Me called Mac Geek Gab, and then I imported that that data into that calendar. And it took a little while for it to push it, you know, all up to the cloud because it's got several years of shows or whatever. And so it pushed it up to the cloud, and that's the point at which I shared that calendar with you, John, and you know the rest is history, as they say.
So very nice.
The net is that it works. If you haven't done it yet, do it. When I did it, I had some problems. I was antsy. I'm impatient, and so I futzed with things probably when I shouldn't have, but I couldn't get the thing to load. And so I instituted one of those Mobile Me chat support sessions, right? I've never done that before. And it was fantastic. They came on, they said, okay, what are you trying to do? I said, well, I started migrating my calendar, but it keeps giving me this error. And the guy's like, well, try it from another computer, which I thought was sort of strange. And because it was all browser based, and I said, well, I've quit the browser and restarted. He's like, no, try it from another computer. And so that started the process, believe it or not. We don't know why. But then I said, well, it's taking, I said, you know, what's the problem? I said, do I have too many events? He said, well, look at this knowledge base article. And it did. It said, you know, if you have more than, I don't know, 7,000 to dos and 20,000 events, we can't migrate you because you just have too much data. I don't know how many I have. I mean, the iCal doesn't give me that information, right? There's no statistics pane that I can see, but the guy on the other end could. And he said, no, you're good. He says, you've got a lot because I have data going back to 1993 in my calendar. He said, no, you've only got like, you know, 7,200 events or whatever it was. I'm like, okay. He said, but it's going to take some time. So you got to chill out. And, you know, once this starts, you just got to let it happen. And I screwed up. I launched BusyCal, I think, before the server had finished configuring things or converting things. And so I wound up pulling things down, and then it wasn't all there, and I wound up pulling it down twice, and I screwed everything up. But I'm a geek, so I can deal with it. And it was my own darn fault anyway.
Yeah. The only thing I noticed, we talked about it before, but I think they have a little bug in the web interface because as we talked about, I'm looking here and I thought they would change the time.
Only with relation to events created in BusyCal, and even then, not all of them. There's a weird, and I don't know where the bug is. I don't know if it's a BusyCal bug or a Mobile Me calendar bug, but there's an issue.
So I looked at the calendar and I saw Mac Geek Gab record for today at 10 o'clock, which.
Yeah, this is calendar on the web.
Yes, Mobile Me on the web, accessing the calendar that you and I share, and it says it's at 10 a.m. And I'm like, well, you know, what do you. You know, first I was going to holler at you like, well, you know, come on, 10 a.m. I mean, let's be civilized here. That's kind of early.
You're over 5 hours late, John.
That's right.
But then what was weird, Dave, is I double click on the event and it says 3 to 5 p.m. as we usually schedule it.
Right.
Because, you know, we do things other than the podcast. Yeah. We have the pre-show and all that. But it shows up properly in the detail when you double click on it in the web interface. Yet on the graphical view in Mobile Me, it shows it. Oh, and look. Oh, and it changed the color, which I did in iCal. Isn't that pleasant?
Yep.
We're going to have a fight over the color, aren't we? Anyway.
Oh, did it change the color for me, too?
I changed it to a nice, happy red.
Oh, well, let me sync here and see. I don't know if it changes it to red. Yeah, because I can't have it red. There'll be none of that. I have red reserved for other things in my calendar, and that's not it. No, it did not change the color for me.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. At least anyway, not in BusyCal. I don't know about the web interface, and I don't really care because I don't use that. So
the migration was pretty smooth. Now, it's funny because I think in the past, you and I noted is that the people that came up with the you know, usually this is a group of people throughout the industry that come up with this, and actually one of the people that was on the board of people that came up with the CalDAV standard was from Apple. So it's kind of funny that it took them this long to, you know, latch on to the standard here.
Well, they've been using CalDAV in macOS 10 server for quite some time, and iCal has supported it for quite some time, but it's just recently that they moved it for MobileMe. That's right. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
All right, cool. So if you have any questions about the new MobileMe calendar, you know, we now do have hands-on experience with it, but my guess is you're probably not going to have many questions with it because it works pretty smoothly. So if you haven't yet taken the plunge, Apple has not forced everyone to take the plunge to migrate. If you haven't, go ahead and do it because it you know, it works really well with all the iOS devices. The syncing is instantaneous. There's none of this mucking with sync services every time you move one event around. iCal is its own client directly, and iCal talks directly to the CalDAV server. There's no middleman. So it works well. And obviously it works really, really well with BusyCal, other than that weird web interface thing that no one really understands yet. But hopefully they'll figure it out, because I'm sure some people care about that. Moving on to our questions for today. Actually, we have a tip to start with, don't we, John? Sort of. A public service announcement from Douglas. Douglas writes, I was listening to Mac Roundtable 95. John, I believe you participated in Mac Roundtable 95.
Yes.
And in describing a situation he had, John casually mentioned that a blinking orange light on the Airport Express meant a firmware update was available. This struck me because a couple of days earlier, I'd noticed the light on my Airport Express was blinking orange. Since my desktop is connected via Ethernet, I made a mental note to look into it later when I had the time. During the course of my day, I ran Apple's update utility and installed the necessary updates. Later, I noticed that my Airport Express light was back to green. I really didn't connect the updates with the Airport Express until John mentioned it on the Mac Roundtable. I've been listening to your show for quite a while and have not heard this. So since there has recently been a firmware update for the Airport Express, I thought it might be a good time to mention this on your show, just in case some of your listeners aren't aware of this feature of the Airport Express. And of course, this is a feature of the time capsule as well.
Right. And the reason I noticed it is, you know, over the holidays, I was at the parents, and as you know, I set up the mom with, you know, a new Airport Extreme and a new computer. And of course, mom being mom, or just since nothing was wrong, but the first thing I noticed when I stepped in the room, because the airport is prominent, was a blinking yellow light. And I'm like, you know, first I'm like, why didn't she call me and say, what is this blinking light? Then again, nothing was malfunctioning.
Right.
But it was indicating that. But I think it's also worth mentioning, Dave, a couple of other, you know, aspects of what that light means. Now, I leave it. Normally, it's always green, and green is good. Green means everything's happy. When it's blinking, there's either a problem with it, and if you run the airport utility, it'll tell you. But you can also go to... if you go to the airport utility and then the airport menu, and then there's an options ... button. And if you look in there, it'll actually say status light, and the default behavior is always on. There is also another behavior where you can say flash on activity. And I don't know if I could stand that. I think that would drive me crazy. But then there's also a checkbox within that menu saying check for firmware updates and the update frequency, whether daily, weekly, or monthly. Of course, I have it on daily because I want to check frequently. So it's worth mentioning that. Now, another thing about the firmware on the airport, which I think is a really nice feature. So if you run the airport utility and you see, it'll show on the left-hand column a list of devices that the airport utility sees. And if you right-click on that, or control-click, or whatever you want to call it, there's going to be a choice, upload firmware, ... Now, this is kind of a nice feature. So say you do apply a new firmware, and I don't think I've ever had this happen, and something goes bad. Something doesn't work and you suspect it's because the firmware is updated. Here's a really cool feature, Dave, is that the airport maintains a history of all the prior ones. So if you right click again on this, on the airport, and then you say upload firmware, it'll say current version, and then it'll say upload version. And if you click on that, it'll give you a list of all the other firmwares that have been on that device. So this is a good problem-solving tool if you suspect that the latest airport firmware has caused you grief. And I'm looking at my list here. It's right now it's 752, but it has 742, 41, 32, 313, or other. So something good to know if you want to troubleshoot your time capsule or your Airport Extreme.
Now, John, you said that you don't have it flash the light on activity because that would drive you crazy. And I'm with you on this, except I've found that for my time capsule, there's an option to have it flash the light on disk activity, which I find really helpful to know if a computer's backing up. So I actually have that on and it doesn't drive me crazy, but I kind of thought it might. But at first I wanted to know. And, you know, when I got it and it doesn't bother me at all. Which surprises me because I'm like you in that way. Mm-hmm. All right. John writes, not you, of course, but for actually new premium listener, John writes, referring to episode 307, I've installed Mac OS 10 on a flash drive and, of course, did a custom installation. But my question is, using an iMac early 2008 to do the install, could I then take this drive to use to boot my MacBook Pro, my MacBook, etc.? We did. In 307, we talked about creating a flash drive as kind of the emergency boot disk. But John brings up a good point that the OS on the disk is only as good as all the Macs that were out at the time that OS was installed. So if you want to make it boot all your Macs, you need to make sure, or if you want to make sure it'll boot later Macs, you need to make sure that you boot from that drive occasionally and continually perform software updates, especially OS updates like, well, in fact, today we had 10.6.6, right? But, you know, keep updating it and that will keep you up to date on being able to boot Macs. But as ties into to another question, in fact, to our next question, you can't have a Snow Leopard boot disk boot PowerPC machines, and of course a Leopard 10.5 boot disk isn't going to boot all the newer Macs. So you may need, depending on how extensive your library of Macs is, you may need to have two USB boot disks, one with the latest Leopard and one with the latest Snow Leopard. Right, John?
Really? Well, I don't know. Well, no. Let me make sure I heard you. So you said a Leopard boot disk will not run on newer machines?
I don't think you can boot your Mac Mini with Leopard. In fact, you can't boot your Mac Mini with anything less than 10.6.5, if I'm not mistaken.
Huh. Well, hold on. Let me try.
Wait.
Everybody wait right here.
Yeah.
No. Okay, that's curious. You know, I would... No, you know, I think I'm with you on that. I think you probably couldn't. But that's a good lead into the next question.
It is. Yeah. Let me pull that up here. Carl wrote in. Carl writes, I'm setting up my mom with my old MacBook Pro, my Mac Pro. See, this is what threw me off here, John. So I'm going to read the question as it stands. Usually we try to kind of interpret here. He says, I'm setting up my mom with my old Mac Pro dual 2 GHz PowerPC G5 running Leopard 10.5.8. Now, of course, you can't have a Mac Pro that's PowerPC. It was either a Power Mac, Power Mac, right? Was what we called those.
Oh, okay. I understand because I caught you.
Yeah. So, right. Okay. I'm going to keep reading.
So I'm going to assume either he got the name of the machine wrong or the processor. I'm going to assume he
got the name wrong.
The machine.
That's right. So he says, on verifying the startup volume using Onyx, I get the following error message. The volume needs to be repaired along with the relevant instructions. However, I can't find my original Leopard install disk to run the disk utility. Can I use my Snow Leopard install disk to repair the volume instead? If not, why not? Okay, so it's potentially a little bit of a trick question. In a very general sense, yes, you can use a disk that is not the version of your OS to repair the file system on the disk. It's just running, it's running a command, essentially running a command called FSCK, which, and there is no OS specific stuff that goes along with that, at least not as relates to, repairing a crummy file system. However, as we just discussed, if this is in fact a PowerPC machine, you cannot boot from the Snow Leopard DVD because Snow Leopard doesn't boot PowerPC machines. So depending on what you actually have, you may need to find a Leopard boot disk of some kind.
Yep.
If that's the path you want to take. But there's
I tried this, Dave,
yeah,
because I was looking at what you said. Again, I missed the mismatch between the machine name and the processor. And I'm like, can you boot a Snow Leopard DVD on a G5? Now, one problem I had. So, of course, I still have the G5. PowerMac G5. I think the exact model that he has here, the 2 gigahertz, dual 2 gigahertz.
Right.
So got my Snow Leopard DVD, put it in the machine, tried to boot it. And as it turns out, I think my DVD drive in this thing is shot because it eventually spit it out.
Okay. Well, maybe it spit it out because it can't boot.
Well, no, it doesn't see it at all. I mean, okay. It should at least be able to mount it, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Just to see it as a disc.
Sure.
So then, well, what do you do? What do you do? Well, I use a very expensive external DVD drive.
FireWire target mode?
Exactly. So I had a FireWire 400 cable, or you could use an 800, plug that into the G5, then plugged it into the Power Mac. And as people may know, but if you don't, there's this very useful thing called target disk mode. And I basically started up, well, put in the disk, then started up the Power Mac and held down T. And what happens is eventually you're going to get a happy little FireWire icon dancing around on the screen. And as you said, it basically makes it a very expensive external DVD drive.
Right.
And I tried that, and then I started up the G5 and held down option because I wanted to run what we call the startup manager, and it showed the drive, which is still in that machine, and the disk never showed up. So, because I think it's... Now, in theory, I think they could make it so that a Snow Leopard disk, you know, being Intel-specific, could boot and run a version of this utility, but I think they're really... trying to, yeah, that just causes headaches.
Right.
So it just doesn't even show up because it doesn't recognize either the code or something else there. But it again, it didn't even show up in the startup manager. So
let's assume that Carl does have a PowerPC machine and only a Snow Leopard DVD, but needs to repair this volume. Now, in order to do a volume repair, you have to take the volume offline. Essentially, it can't be the boot volume. Right. So there is, you know, the main way to do that is to boot from another source. But you can boot from that drive and catch it very early in the startup process and still do the repairs. And Apple has called this single user mode. If you hold down Command S when you boot the machine, that will boot you to a command line. And there's a command you're going to run, and it's that same FSCK command that I mentioned earlier. And what you need to type is sitting right there above the line where you need to type it. So it's not even worth going through the command here because you're going to know it anyway. It's right there. And you type that and it will run through and fix things. Of course, this is why I always recommend to install Applejack. Applejack is a utility that sits at your single user mode command line and allows you to do a lot of things. Now, they're all things that you could do if you knew the terminal commands to type to do them. It doesn't actually add anything, at least not in this regard, but it makes life a whole lot easier to be able to just have it and say, go run, and it just does everything, and you don't have to remember all your terminal commands. So, and Applejack is free. So applejack.sourceforge.net is where to get that. But even without Applejack, very easy to run the file system check from the command line. So that's probably your best answer there, Carl. Anything else, John, on this one? Or are we moving to Daniel?
We're moving.
All right.
Hi, Dave and John. Thank you for your show. My name's Daniel from Ontario, Canada. I'll start off with a quick tangent to my original question. Just wanted to record my question on a quick voice note and realize that there doesn't seem to be a simple application for that on my iMac like there is on my iPhone. But I've since found QuickTime and hopefully this will work.
Seems to work.
I've been a user of an iMac for about 2 years now. It took me about 22 years to convert from a PC user, but I will never look back. Love it. Anyways, my question has to do with mail. I haven't done anything unusual that I know of, but recently I can't seem to send mail out dependably without having to shut down my mail application and having it store my outbound messages into the outbox automatically, then restarting mail, and then I see my outbound messages get delivered. So I'm not sure why. I frequently have to do that though now. Sometimes it works, but after a few attempts, usually my outbound messages will just sit there idling and not actually get sent out without the restarting of the mail application. Just wondering if you have any insights on how to resolve that annoying little problem. Thank you so much, and have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Daniel. So I don't know the magic answer here, John, but...
I do.
Good.
But I'll let you give it a crack first.
Oh, thanks. Okay. All right. So the way that I would troubleshoot this is there's two things that you can do. First is open up, if you go to the window menu in Mail and go to the activity window, it's going to come up and show you every connection that Mail has open at that point in time. Now, when Mail is sitting idle, this should show nothing. What I would say to do is create a new message, click send, and see if anything shows up here. That would be kind of my first step, just to see. Okay, because clearly sometimes it's working, but sometimes it's not. Then the other thing to do is you can, if you go to the back to the window menu and go to the connection doctor. Right below that.
That was my answer.
That was your answer. Oh, sorry, John. I wish I
used
that.
I used this the other day because I did have a problem with an outgoing email. And one of my, I think I had recently changed the password and I wasn't getting an explicit error from Mail. But it showed up as you point out, Dave, there's the connection doctor and it shows each of your, I believe, outgoing or maybe incoming and outgoing. And one of them had a little red dot next to it.
Right.
And yeah. So go on. But yes, that is, I think, the best tool to diagnose Mail problems. And again, it disappointed me that Mail itself didn't say, dude, your password's wrong or it was something similar to that. And it didn't tell me. I had to go to the connection doctor to find that out.
So the connection doctor is cool because it does exactly what you said, but it also has a little show detail button at the bottom. And essentially, you know, I mentioned before how I like to see the logs in BusyCal. Well, that's what this shows you here. It shows you excruciating detail about the entire connection that happens between Mail and whatever server it's talking to. So if you have three or four Mail accounts and you go check Mail on this, you'll get a laundry list of stuff come by. You won't be able to see what's happening, but let it go through, let it calm down, and then go send your new message and you will see what's happening here. And you might be able to see, okay, look, it's trying to connect to this server. It's not working. But that's where I would go to troubleshoot that. Of course, then, you know, Mail, preferences, accounts, select any account. And then on the account information tab at the bottom is the outgoing Mail server where it says SMTP. And go and take a look at that. You might even want to edit the SMTP server list and delete any extraneous servers. It's possible you've got some laggard server out here that doesn't work, but when you relaunch Mail, maybe. Well, that was odd. We had a very strange audio error here, but we're back. Anyway, when you relaunch Mail, John, you're still with us, yes?
Absolutely.
Excellent. Okay, good. But, you know, when you relaunch Mail, it might go and try a different server or something like that. And that could be the solution here. So you might have some dead SMTP server out there that you just need to remove from your list. So that's what I have on that one, John. I stole your thunder unintentionally. I thought we'd pass it back and forth, but,
no, that's fine. The only thing, I don't even know if I want to suggest using Telnet to Telnet directly to the Mail port and try to fiddle with that, because that gets a bit too geeky even for premium, because I've done that in the past. I mean, it's not so bad with SMTP or POP. The standards are published and you can, again, use the Telnet application either from the command line or a Telnet application. And typically what you do is instead of Telnetting to the normal Telnet port, which is what, 20, I forget. But you can tell that the Telnet will take an argument, which is the another port to go to. And a lot of these protocols, the email protocols, will operate in plain text, and you can go to them. And I've done this in a pinch when I didn't have an email client handy, just to see if the server was even talking to me. You know, a lot of them, like POP, if you telnet to it and you say user, capital USER, and your username, and pass, and your password, and then list, you can list your email messages. And again, that gets a little bit geeky. I'll see if I can find an article that goes over that. But you shouldn't need to do that. The connection, actually, and from what I see, Dave, the connection doctor in the detail view pretty much is doing that. It's showing you the raw, the raw commands that are going back and forth, and it can be a bit overwhelming because there's a lot happening there.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Okay. Moving on. You know, let's go to Michael. Michael asks a great question. He says, I'm having not a problem, but more of a question about the different types of setups that you can have with a second router on the network. Currently, I have an Airport Extreme and an Airport Express. In the Airport Express, when I go into Airport Utility, I see the four options under wireless network setup. I see join wireless network, extend a wireless network, participate in a WDS network, and create a wireless network. Can you tell us what these are and what they all mean? And yes, Michael, we can. So this is interesting because some of these are similar. So I'm going to start with the first one that you mentioned, which is join a wireless network. This is only an option that's available on the Airport Express. Essentially, what it does is it allows the Airport Express to connect to a wireless network, and it doesn't have to be an Apple network, as a client, just like your iPhone or your Mac or anything else does. Now, this is a little weird for a router to just connect as a client, but again, the Airport Express also has some other functionality, that being the music streaming and all that. So you may want to just have it be a client and not have it do any sort of, server-based or networking or be a host for anything that is just its own client. So that's what that one does. Correct, John, you've got an Airport Express, and that's what that does, right?
I really don't.
You've never done that.
I don't think I use that.
Okay.
Which one? I'm sorry.
Join a wireless network.
No, okay. I think you've mentioned that you've done it when you're on the road. So yeah. So you glom onto another network, I guess.
That's right. Okay. So then that leaves three left. The first one is the default, which is create a wireless network. This is what we're all used to when we get our routers. They broadcast their own network and you can connect to them and then via the router connect to the internet or what have you. And I'm going to go out of order actually at this point. There's participate in a WDS network. Now, in a very general sense, WDS stands for wireless distribution system, and it allows you to extend a wireless network by linking together base stations that are within range of one another. There are three roles that a base station can play in a WDS network: main, or the server that kind of holds things, relay, and remote. So again, yeah, main is the originator of the network. Remote is a station that pushes the signal to otherwise out of range wired or wireless clients. And relay bounces the signal between main and remote. So relay isn't going to let any clients connect, to my knowledge. It's only going to let other WDS base stations connect, and it can be the thing that allows it to hop further than it already might. Of course, you all know my feelings on this. Get power line and you're good to go. You don't want to mess around with actually extending a wireless network, but that's what those things do.
Relay.
Yeah.
You know, I think Relay does two roles. I just very quickly, while we were talking, brought up an article that Apple has in their knowledge base, and Relay, it looks like it lets you either let a remote talk to it or a wireless client. So I guess it provides two roles here. And then a remote, it looks like, just goes to a wireless client.
Or wired,
yes.
Right.
So, but you know that, WDS, I think Apple does a good job of making it as, to me, it gets overly technical with all this terminology and stuff. I mean, it's obvious what I think most people want to do. You want to take one base and make it part, extend another.
Well, that goes to the fourth and final option, which is in Apple's menu of extend a wireless network. And with this, as long as you're using only Apple base stations, you can do this. And it effectively creates a WDS network without you having to figure out how to do all this stuff. And that works really well. Of course, again, it has to be all Apple stuff because, you know, Apple stuff knows how to talk to other Apple stuff, presumably, and all that. So, yeah, they do. They auto configure. It's zero configuration for WDS, I guess, is the way to talk about that. Right, John?
Mm-hmm.
But again, just get Powerline. It's much simpler. And I've never seen WDS work well. Have you? I know we've talked about this. We've beat this to death, but
The thing is, when I've seen it happen, Dave, I mean, a lot of people, their goal is to extend their signal.
Right.
And the thing is, if your signal at some point sucks, then WDS is just going to help
it suck more.
Help extend a signal that's already kind of dicey. So yeah, I don't think I've ever had really good luck with it. Yeah. I would either, you know, get a better antenna or reposition or something like that. But
presumably, it's got to work somewhere. I mean, there's enough people talking about WDS that, well, you know where WDS works is when you've got a highly focused. So most of us are used to what I'm going to call very, very short range Wi-Fi connections. And that is the round kind of connection that we have in our house, you know, omnidirectional from a base station. It just broadcasts its signal out. And, you know, if you're within anywhere between 10 and 300 feet worth of range, depending on what you've got in the way. Right. Well, I believe it's WDS that's used for this. The other thing that you can do with Wi-Fi is you can focus it down into a unidirectional signal, and you've got to aim two dishes at each other, so that you get a tight focus, but you can go several miles with Wi-Fi that way. And it works really, really well. I had a friend in Texas. This was years ago. I'm assuming that he's gotten a cable modem by now or something. But at the time, that was not available. He was out kind of in the outskirts of Austin. And I think I mentioned it on the show how much it blew me away that there we were. And he had his little antenna on the top of the house. And he was just a remote, I guess, at this point. Or no, he was a client on a network. And he would just, you know, get the signal, and his little router would then, you know, he could then broadcast inside his house. But it was this, you know, microwave essentially going from somebody about a mile and a half away. And it worked fine. And my uncle up in Maine did the same thing. He set up a WDS between two homes that he has because he was too cheap to pay for a second cable modem connection. And he had this one line of sight. He had to cut down one tree, but it crossed his neighbor's property to this other house that he has down a hill. And he just aimed that stuff perfect, and it worked fine. So, yeah. So that's probably where this WDS stuff comes from. I have to guess. I mean, otherwise, why would, you know, I've never seen it work, but maybe that's just me.
Yeah. Yeah. Are we gonna do Dan, or are we going to save Dan for later? I just like Dan's.
We can do Dan. That's fine.
It's just kind of it reveals something cool.
It does. Yep. Okay. So yeah, let's see if we can boil this down to its essence. Dan writes, earlier today, I went into the airport utility to check and see if my time capsule had any firmware updates or anything. I've recently acquired a brother printer and added it on the network. I can tell what it is when looking in airport utility as it displays its model number for the client ID. The strange thing I have on the network, which seems to just have appeared as of today, is a device with the client ID, and he lists some ID. And it's Poodelek, P-O-O-D-E-L-E-K, which doesn't have any, none of us know, you know, anything. It's probably just somebody named it that way. My network here has a mixture of Macs and Windows machines on it. I've checked all the devices we usually have on the network, and none of them have this name, nor the IP that this mystery device has been given. I, of course, have the network locked down with WPA2 personal security, and I have a good password on it. If this is a snooper on my network, how in airport utility can I boot them off? I can't see any easy way to do this. All right, so go.
I got it. All right, so short answer is, as far as I know, there is not a way to boot the person off, but I want to dig into this because this is mysterious. So he is on the screen where if you go in the airport utility, it's airport, then you click on wireless clients, than DHCP clients, or I'm going to assume that. Now, what this shows you, assuming that the airport is doing DHCP, is you're going to see a number of values in this table, Dave. MAC address, IP address, client ID, which is, I assume, where he gets this from. And this is something you can provide for a DHCP device. And whoever, you know, Mr. Evil is doing that. And then lease time. Here's the part that's cool, Dave. The MAC address. Now, when you look at that, that's kind of a random string of hex digits. What does it mean? How can you tell what's the significance? I'm going to tell you, Dave. Rather than having a mishmash of these and people just selecting these randomly, there is a rhyme and reason to them, and that there is actually an authority that says, all right, you vendor A, vendor B, whoever you are, I'm going to give you this range of MAC addresses, and these are the MAC addresses that you're allowed to use. So my first suggestion is get that MAC address. Again, I'm going to assume the device is in this table. And then I found a very nice site here. We will put it in the show notes. But if you type in a MAC address, it will tell you who owns it. And I almost bet you if he types in the MAC address of whoever's on the network, it's going to tell him. And, you know, so I think I've had this happen in the past where there may be a forgotten device in the household somewhere that you just forgot. It's an iPod Touch. It's a network adapter. It's something in a closet somewhere. You just forgot that you did it. But this is going to tell you. And, you know, in my case, you know, if it's a Mac, it'll say Apple. If it's a TiVo adapter, it'll say TiVo. My iFi card, it says iFi. So it's pretty specific as to who owns that. And I almost guarantee that that's going to tell him who it is.
Yep.
Now, a few more follow-ups to wrap it up. What he's doing is excellent. WPA2 is the best security that you're going to get. I would suggest, though, make sure you put not just numbers and letters in there, but maybe some special characters. Another thing I would do, and I do this on my base station, some people say that it's kind of a way. Well, he also asked, should I not broadcast my SSID? I don't think that it'll hurt to not do that. There are ways to prod a base station to reveal that. But if you're among many targets in an area, it's better if you don't broadcast it to keep the newbies out. Another thing I would do, and I do this on mine, is I also restrict. Well, I do two things. I restrict who can access my access point based on MAC address. Again, it's not foolproof, and people can fake the, you can use ifconfig to fake your MAC address, but it's just another level of security to keep people out. And actually comes in handy because you can also do your DHCP reservations using the MAC address. And I use them for both, Dave. And then that's actually another issue that we'll come up with. So, and what you do is you just say MAC address. Basically, you say default behavior, no access. And then all the devices that you want to have permission to access it, you give them permission. So, but cool. I'd be fascinated. I really want to hear back from Dan and find out who owns that MAC address, because it's probably going to, I think it's going to be a head slap saying, oh no, it's this device that I forgot about. Or it could be some evil hacker dude.
Yep.
In which case, again, I couldn't find a feature that'll kick somebody off. But if you apply these security settings and then restart it, that'll kick them off. And then I think if you, again, filter by MAC address, it's going to keep them from coming in again, or at least make it a lot tougher.
You know, I use that DDWRT firmware on my router here, and it's got that MAC address lookup functionality built into it.
Oh, sweet.
If you click on a MAC address in any of the lists where a MAC address would appear, it automatically pulls you to that web page and does the lookup for you, and it just pops up in a window. And yeah, you're right. I do it all the time. You know, I'll be looking. I'll think, what device? You know, because I do DHCP reservations for all of my standard devices here. So when I see something outside of my, you know, reserved IP range, well, that, you know, that makes me scratch my head. And so I click on it, and invariably it'll be like, oh yeah, that's right. You know, we replaced my iPhone or whatever, and got a new MAC address, and that's why it's, you know, got a thing, or there's just something. But like you said, yeah, there's always that head slap where you go, oh yeah, that's what it is. No problem.
If anything, if it is an attacker, what I'm going to guess the weakness here is that he probably chose a password that either has dictionary words or numbers. And as far as I know, the airport will not prevent you from incessantly trying to get into it.
Right.
So it could be somebody that's just in the neighborhood and is very, very determined. And again, the airport's not going to reject them.
No.
Attempts, they're going to keep trying to log in.
Another way to secure it or to block this person out would be to just change the password. I mean, that comes with the pain in the neck that you got to then go around and re-log in with all your machines. But if that one reappears after you do that, well, then, you know, something wacky's going on.
Now, one more thing in the airport utility, Dave, and I just noticed this, but I think it's worth mentioning here. So in airport utility, I was going through the menus to try to find a feature that would kick people off, but I found something else that is kind of novel, but I think it could present a security risk. So if you go to the base station menu and you say add wireless clients, and I don't know if you've ever been here, Dave, but it says wireless client setup assistant. There are two ways you can allow a client to join your password protected network without entering a password. Uh-oh. You can either enter a PIN for the user or allow access to the first client that attempts to join your network.
Huh.
I'm going to assume that this feature was not enabled, but if it was,
yeah.
And it has a radio button. It says allow client by PIN or by first attempt. So hopefully someone has, and it also has a checkbox saying limit client access to 24 hours. So on the one hand, that's a nice thing if you don't want to go through the hassle of entering MAC addresses and or giving out your password and you want to allow people to come on temporarily like a house guest or something. But make sure someone hasn't fiddled with that menu. That's the other reason I think somebody could have gotten in.
Right, right. All right, I think we have, we've got time for about, well, you know what? Let's do Keith here. Keith says, I'm coming up on my 1 year with my 27-inch i7 iMac, and it is starting to have some issues waking up or turning on. In any case, where's the best place for me to get a good price on AppleCare? I am a legit EPP member, employee purchase program member, but the 6% is really only the discount of sales tax. Where else can I go? Okay, well, the three places I check are Small Dog, Amazon, and LAComputerCompany.com. And more often than not, my purchases wind up from the last one because they've got typically got the best prices. Now, John, you just bought AppleCare or are about to for your new Mac Mini.
Well, I think I will. And you know, Dave, the thing is I went to, and I found this an excellent tool, frugal.com, which is part of Google.
Yep.
And when I searched there, Dave, I actually found, so I searched for, and I'm going to do it live here for the studio audience, AppleCare Mac Mini. And I brought up a list. And oh my gosh, you know the best price I got was from buy.com, $95.
Versus $149 from Apple, right?
And you know, now how did I know what the price was from Apple, Dave? And I'm going to tell you, and I think we can toss this in here. And this is a good closer because this site, you and I both saw this and we were like, oh my gosh, this site rocks. So Apple just released this recently. I saw a tweet out there somewhere. I think it was the Macworld guys or something. Supportprofile.apple.com. This is the OCD. If you are OCD and you want to have a list of all your equipment, assuming that you've registered or even if you have not, I think this is similar to the screen that the Apple people see when you call them up. But Dave, I mean, both you and I looked at it. When you go to this site and you log in, and again, assuming that you've registered your equipment with your Apple ID, it shows you every piece of equipment that you have. It shows you support calls. It showed my latest AppleCare support call. It'll let you register things if you type in the serial number. And it also shows you, and that's how I found out. So, you know, I had my Mac Mini registered on the site and it said, well, dude, you don't have AppleCare. Well, click on this button and you can buy it. And I'm like, $149. Well, I know I can get a better price than that.
Cool. Yeah, that'll, I think that'll, yep, there's the band. I knew they were around somewhere. It's cold outside.
Storms are brewing, Dave.
The storms, that's what I hear.
It's your fault again.
I'm looking forward to it. You know, we had a haiku contest for three Macworld passes, Macworld Expo passes, and we have winners. And I'm going to read two of them here, John. The first runner up, I guess, would be from Dan. And he says, I read TMO, Macs, iPads, iPhones, they know. Expo, here we go. So that was a pretty good one. I like that. And there were a lot of good entries, but the distance between, and second was good, don't get me wrong, but the distance between second and first was a chasm so wide that there was just no, I mean, there was no way that anybody came close to this. And so here we go. In fact, we're going to pause the music here for a second. Philip wrote, catch your Macworld bliss, an apple each day to kiss. You won't want to miss. Coming in a week, it's your chance to catch a peek at items to seek. With old friends to greet, through several days on your feet, and new friends to meet. Impart what you know, discover what you don't know, you've come to the show. gadgets and hardware, latest and greatest software, you'll find it all there. We'll make it all clear what we really want in gear and features next year. They'll make it, we'll choose. What items we'll win or lose, what we'll really use. With Jobs off hissing, see what Apple is missing, what it is dissing. Community here, the gathering of your peers, laughing, clapping, cheers. Good friends helping friends, points to debate and defend to the very end. Now that it's over, in a time of composure, you'll find your closure. You won't want to miss an apple each day to kiss. Catch your Macworld bliss. That's it. I mean, you know, like wow. I said, yeah. You gonna make it, Pete?
Yeah, sorry about that. I was gonna hit the mute button.
Yeah. So that's the that was the winner, Philip. Excellent job on that, and excellent job by everybody. There were some fantastic entries that we saw come in, but that was the one. That was the one. We are going to Macworld Expo. It is January 27th through 29th. On the 27th, sometime in the afternoon, I think 2 p.m. Let's call it 2. Might be 1. I'm doing my Mac, running your Mac lean, clean, and mean session. Saturday afternoon at 5 p.m., closing the show floor, John and I will do a live Mac Geek Gab with a Stump the Geek and perhaps some cool stuff found. You can send in your comment. Oh, we still have a deal on hotels for Macworld Expo at the Intercontinental. You can get a room there. It's at the normal Expo price, but you are guaranteed to get an upgrade if you do it through the TMO link, which we will put in the show notes. It's also in the sidebar over there at MacObserver.com. Contact information, of course, you can reach us premium at MacGeekGab.com.
No.
Say it ain't so.
You got it all wrong, Dave. It's premium at MacGeekGab.
Oh, my mistake. Yes, premium at MacGeekGab.com. 206-66-GEEK-6. No, that's not the number.
Whoa.
It's 206-66-66-GEEK, which, John, is
4335.
That's right. You can Skype us to MacGeekGab and all of that good stuff. Next week, on Monday, we're doing cool stuff found again. So send in your stuff. It's going to be we've already got a long list, and I'm looking forward to seeing what else comes in between now and then. So we have Communicators is the podcast that Michael Johnston does, and he converts the Mac Geek Gab into AAC for all of you. Cashfly provides the bandwidth, and that's it. We're out of here. Got anything else, John?
I think I'm about done.
Good.
Oh, I did get. Oh, I got some new toys.
You did?
Oh, I got some new batteries.
You have to tell us about it and cool stuff found, man. I hear we're doing that show next week.
Well, the thing is, at Macworld, Dave, batteries, you don't want to get caught without them. Ah, messed that up. Don't get caught!